Welcome. They just rang the bell, so people have been fantastic about promptness here at Holden, and I've actually had to, I've walked into a couple of sessions late, so I'm not the paragon. But I'm trying to respect everyone's time. It's the last day for many people, and I know that we want to do many things, so I will get going so that we can get it all in. This is day 5 of City Blank God, City of God, City by God, City for God. What is the relationship between cities and God and God's creatures, us, and what are our relationships between each other in cities, and are cities good for those relationships? Are they bad for those relationships? And little questions like that. And I want to thank in particular, Chris Sharon and Sonia Batalman, the teaching coordinators this week, because they have put together an incredible set of people who have informed each other's conversations. And in particular, Alan's work has been so closely related to mine in ways, I mean, to me anyway, maybe others don't see it that way, but on Wednesday, Alan talked about the economics of the gospel, and I talked about economics, and then he talked today about conflict resolution, and I'm going to talk about conflict resolution. So it's really kudos to Chris and Sonia, and thank you. And there's one other thing which I'd like to do, and I will do, is which, who was it, Vespers the other, no, is it, anyway, Mike said, I've always wanted to do this, right?
Mark,
thank you, Sarah. And this is something I've always wanted to do because I don't get to do this in my professional calling. Pray with me. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, Lord. Thank you. So today we will try to wrap up in a way. Each day we've raised certain problems with the city and tried to suggest solutions. And we've tried to suggest solutions each day, but there are always questions about other ways that the city can improve, and we've lumped the answers to those in today. What should we do? How will we know good community design when we see it? And who should decide what constitutes good community design?
Me, of course.
Of course you should.
Right.
So, okay. So, who all has been to one other of my sessions? At least one? Okay, and I'm going to skip the introduction part since you've all met me now. And you've also heard me acknowledge my debt to this book, and I believe that the bookstore...
It is in the bookstore.
But what I'm saying is that they have actually sold most of their copies. I think there's one left.
Oh, dear.
So get up there, and if they are sold out, it's still in print, and there are a lot of used copies because it does tend to get used, so it shouldn't be too hard to find. And then on Wednesday, I waxed ecstatic about the insights and the Klosky's of You're So Smart, the Narrative of Economic Expertise, and I encourage you to look for that as well. A little other review, where did the city come from a need and desire to for contact, and I talked about this on Monday or Tuesday. Anyway, that night at dinner, I was saying that people came together in cities not for protection, right? The first cities were not, in fact, walled cities. They were the product of peace, or at least an internal kind of peace in the Babylonian kingdom. And they, in the way I told the story, because this is the way I understood it, was that they had invented agriculture, and then that produced surplus, and so they got together to do things like trade and make art and have religious ceremonies, which happened to, it was much easier to have them in one place and to build, right, and to begin with. And I was told at dinner that it was, archaeologists are now deciding that some of these might be actually backwards, like you might have gotten together for art only, right? And that they have found a place in Ukraine or something where apparently if you work backwards, people went there because there were good artistic materials there, good clay, not just for practical pot making, but for artistic. And then because everyone was there, then they started a city. And in any case, the city is clearly there to produce relationships. And the main thing that I wanted you to take away from that day is the city is a
human
invention. Excellent. Very good. There's something something that we don't like about the city, whose fault is that? Right? It's our fault. So we can do something about it. And then on Wednesday, I talked about economics, and money is a... Very good. Thank you. And I told some stories, the kind of stories that economics experts tell, and we worked together to try and evaluate how do we evaluate economics stories, particularly if we ourselves do not think that we are experts. And one of the suggestions that I made, and I shared some difficulty on this point, was you should ask if the storyteller is good company. Is you trust the storyteller? And is the storyteller, in addition to getting his or her facts right, do they also demonstrate an ethos and a pathos? Do they identify with you and do you identify with them? And do you think ultimately, even if they have their facts right, maybe you don't buy their story even if their facts are right? Have you ever had someone tell you a story and you say, well, you seem to have your facts right, but I'm still not buying it? Mm-hmm. Ever had that reaction?
Because facts don't matter.
Well, they're not the only thing that matters to people.
Usually
right?
Values.
Right? And so you can judge that for yourself, whether that's true. I'm going to add to this, it's not only review, but I'm going to add to this because in my profession, I am often talking about transit and land use, right? And I will talk to a group like this. No one has asked me this yet, remarkably enough, not in exactly this way. So what do you do? Where do you live? How do you get to work, Mr. Schroer, Mr. Expert? I'm going to test your story, right? And what are the two responses to that? What are my only two responses? So I've said, I'll make it easy, right? Everyone should take the bus to work. Taking the bus is good for the community, it's good for the environment, it's good for economics, it's good for, I don't say that that's the only good thing, but for the purposes of this, right? Taking the bus to work is good. Oh, how do you get to work, Will? What are my only two responses?
Yes or yes.
Yes or no. Now, if I say yes, what is the immediate response?
Good for you.
Or, if you're not wild about the bus?
Easy for you to say.
Well, that's a good one, too. Okay. Or, oh, I get it. You just want me to be just like you. And if I don't take the bus, I may... So what? The facts are all there. It's all true that you save money by taking the bus. There'll be fewer emissions. Right? The facts remain whether I'm a hypocrite or not. But apparently, I don't believe my own story. And if I don't believe my story, and Alan said this again, I'm just going to do this all night, Alan. You already said it, right? People apparently, the church, this is what he said, if the church says there's living water, right? But we test the story. Does it look like the people are actually living like there's? Not so much. They test the story whether or not it sounds like a good story. And so that is a challenge. Because, it's a challenge for obvious reasons. So one of the things that my profession has done, not only to get out of the problem of storytelling, because there's no good answer to that question, is to take ourselves out of the story. What did Alan do this morning? He had probably some good suggestions about how you should talk to your spouse, etc., but ultimately he said, you guys have to work this out. Here's some rules for working it out, but you have to work it out. So that's one of the ways that we do it. And what I would like to talk to you today about is conflict resolution and urban planning. So in professional presentations, this is called a case study, but for us, I will call it a story. Once upon a time, there was a big naval air station outside Boston, and Massachusetts is getting pretty crowded, and 1,300 acres of decommissioned naval air station, and the origin of this was that's where they put the blimps for North Atlantic anti-submarine warfare. And blimps take up a lot of space. So it was a large base, and we don't have blimps anymore, so they didn't need it anymore. So this is my colleague, Margaret, standing, and I tell the short story because it's not really important what they used to use it for, but I can't not tell the whole story because it just feels dishonest. First there were blimps, then it was a jet fighter training school, and they have this enormous runway so jets can take off. And so here's Margaret standing at the intersection of the north, south, and east, west runways. And it's just enormous. And this is Massachusetts, and when the Air Force took the base, they took it. They took it. We'll take this land, thank you very much. And it happened to fall in parts of three different Massachusetts townships. Okay, and so now they're turning the land back to three Massachusetts townships, all of whom run on town meeting government. So once a year, the town gets together and has a big big exercise in pure democracy. And if you can't pass something at that meeting, it doesn't happen. At least not until next year. So your parishioners met once a week at three. This town meets once a year. And so everyone gets ready for that meeting and they get their story straight before the meeting, and they test out their story on their neighbors. And so there's a lot of prep, right? And it's not the only time they talk to each other, but that's kind of the deadline. And if you can't get it past that year, then you got to wait a whole other year worth of town, you know, talking to your neighbor, coffee, et cetera. So one town had a group of concerned citizens that said, I have been hearing about smart growth, and I think that we should build a smart growth development on this 1,300 acres. And the next town said, I too have been hearing about smart growth, and boy, have I never heard of a more communist plot to take away our freedom. Forget it. And the third town fell somewhat in between. And I'm absolutely not making this up for argument's sake. This is exactly where people were. And one town said, I know what we can do to solve this clashing of opinions. Let's call in some experts and they can explain smart growth to us. And the other town said, I don't even want to hear it because I already know who those clowns are. They're here from the UN and the black helicopters and Agenda 21. And I don't even want to hear it. Right? And the smart growth people, but listen to the facts. No. They're experts. No. And if you have to call in experts, we're calling our own experts. The driving is good and everyone wants a single, you know, right? They're probably right. They wouldn't be making up those facts either. So we got called and we said, we have a little issue here. And so we said, why doesn't everybody come up with their desired plan? And so the base case here was a big mall, actually, surrounded by office buildings. And one of the things that Town 1 was really concerned about was children. They hate the idea, it's not that they dislike children, they dislike paying for the children's schools. And another town said, no, we heard all about smart growth and we should really build compactly and leave this all open for green space, of which there's very little left in Massachusetts, it's so damn crowded. Another group of people said, we hired some experts and Dover Cole is a big new urbanist design firm, and they came up with this one. And then we really liked this sort of idea of New England villages. So here's a little village and a road, and here's a little village and a road, and here's a little village and a road, right? And they hired not experts; they hired not even plant. Do what we tell you, and they will draw the picture for you, right? So no one's saying necessarily off the bat that this is an expert thinks this is a good idea. This is what we think is a good idea. So. So there's all these, and then, you know, the only other rule really was that you had to avoid the wetlands. The runway ran this way and this way, and they left the wetlands. Okay, so we have all the space to work with. What should we do with it? So we call everyone together, and we say, well, what do you actually want out of this space? Let's not talk about smart growth. Let's not put labels on. Let's not evaluate right off the bat, right? Step back and get away from the labels. Well, everyone cares about the environment, they care in different amounts, obviously, but nobody cares not in the least. Everyone wants some jobs, they want some recreation and proximity to parks. People feel differently about amounts of housing, but they want their housing to be near something if it's going to be. And anyway, we don't have to go through this whole list, but the point is you get everyone together and you say, what do you care about? And you make a list. And surprisingly, even though people say they care about different things when they're waving banners, when you actually sit them down and ask them what makes a good town, they're surprisingly on the same page in my professional experience. And then you say, so what if you want to be able to walk to a bus stop, or you think that a good town has the ability to walk to a bus stop, do you call in an artist? Frank Lloyd Wright was a town planner, right? He designed cities. He didn't plot bus stops by computer. He was an artist. And then he said, and this is beautiful, and you should live like this, right? Well, if you don't want to take Frank's word for it, what do you do? Do you say, well, we want to be able to walk to the grocery store. Let's see how the different plans do on being able to walk to the grocery store. Well, here's a grocery store, let's say. And you have to walk to the grocery store. And back in the day, almost 3 or 4 years ago, the Dark Ages, computers could only measure the distance from this house to this house in a crow flies line. But nobody actually flies to the grocery store. Only crows can get away with that. So computers can now say, if you tell me where the roads are, I will walk in my computer head from the house, and you see there's no connection here? And if you came to the transportation section, the session, you know all about the lack of connectivity and how bad that is. So we can't walk this way, right? We have to walk on this little windy cul-de-sac-y thing. Yeah. And that's a 2,000-foot walk to the grocery store, and so these houses are red. They look like they're close, but they're actually really far away to walk to the grocery store. Only these houses are green. And we plot transit stops. If we put a stop here and here, and you actually can't walk from here to here because the highway department won't put a sidewalk on the main road, then you have to walk all the way around, and this is right. So you computer model all this stuff, and computers are your friends, so you don't have grad students with rulers trying to measure all this stuff. And then you produce a score. Okay? Are you with me so far? This all seems plausible? You do all this? Okay? And then you score everything. And you say, I still don't want to hear any labels, but we will start evaluating. And so here's plan one, and it's mostly red, and here's plan two, and it's still mostly red, and here's plan three, and it's starting to get green. And don't look at this last column yet, and I didn't do the computer jazz to hide that, but just don't look at it. So, right, we have all these plans, and some of them, even the bad one has 6 greens and 14 reds, and the okay one has 14 and 15 green. On the things that we care about, and only 5 bads. And so we took this, you know, to the community. It still wasn't town meeting yet, but we took it to the various representatives and said, this is, you know, you guys came up with different plans, and here's how they scored on the values that you yourselves expressed. No experts, no storytellers, no Will Schroer being a hypocrite. This is what you want. And they said, well, that's actually pretty darn good. We'd still like to get rid of that 5 bad stuff. I mean, we have a new... We're creating a new town here. You keep telling us it's up to us. Let's get the best damn town we can get. Can you go back to the drawing board and get rid of those last 5 reds? So we sent Dover Coal back to the drawing board. And they came up with the preferred plan. And, you know, I was claiming on Wednesday that economics and town planning are really dismal. You can actually produce good. And there's not infinite number of trade-offs. You can have what you want if we arrange things correctly. That's not entirely true. We couldn't get rid of all of the bad performance, right? But we got better than any of the initial plans. And if we'd had an infinite amount of time and money, we could have iterated probably until we, but you know, you don't want the perfect to be the enemy of the good. So it was the plan that was preferred. Now we're evaluating, right? It was preferred according to the values that the community itself expressed, as then evaluated by the neutral, who's the only computer. Never let anyone tell you computers are neutral, because someone had to decide what was good, a good score, right? I had to decide what was a good score. So I'm not out of the picture altogether. But look at the role. So I keep saying, well, you decided and the experts didn't decide. Someone had to draw the towns, right? And I was thinking by analogy with some of the other stuff we've been talking about this week, the role of expert in this, not telling you what to do, but helping you get there. And you still need some expertise. that's not going to work. I'm not even going to draw and evaluate that plan because it's not going to work. It's a waste of money, right? And someone has to know how to do this. But these are support functions. It's a different kind of expertise. So we took the preferred plan to all three town meetings, and then, remember, we're telling a story. In the beginning, there was open space, then we did this, and there was a disagreement. And then they called in an expert, but a different kind of expertise. And in the end, all three town meetings passed the plan. Awesome. So I did this a couple of times in different places. You don't need 1,300 acres in outside Massachusetts. So Burlington, Vermont grew around what used to be their fairgrounds, and they wanted new fairgrounds further out. So we had this nice chunk of town inside Burlington, exact same situation. Should we, you know, do a more, I won't say traditional, but more conventional development, or should we do a this kind of thing and ask the Burlingtonians what they want, score it against, and one thing, there was no existing vicinity in South Weymouth, so that we couldn't do this, but in one plan, things actually got worse, and in another plan, things actually got better. That's pretty nice. And so they did the one thing. One of the nice things about coming up with indicators of what people actually want is then you can track progress towards it. The Burlington thing got done just as sort of Burlington's economy got weak, so they didn't do it all at once. They did phase one, which got them sort of the way toward where they wanted to get to, and then phase two eventually will get them here. And developers like that because they don't want to be held to an absolute plan because markets change and things change and the cost of wood goes up or whatever, and you say, well, we're not going to tell you exactly what to do, but whatever you build has to perform like this. So you believe in people like that. So who should decide? Should experts decide? I mean, I think I have something to contribute, and I appreciate being asked. But I actually don't like going to towns and saying, this is what you should do. Not only do I not want to be put on the spot, well, what do? Because it came out the other day, yesterday we were talking about how are the kids, right? And I was preaching the virtues of walking to school, and somebody says, well, how do your kids get to school? They take the bus. So, community should decide. And even here, you know, there's a lot of questions about how to do this. This used to be a radical technique, and you know, there's three steps in every introduction of any new technique. That's ridiculous. That will never work. Well, it might work, but it would be very hard. And then I have always said that would work, right? And any thinking person will do it that way. So this is done now quite frequently. People have different opinions about how to do it. This is a case where every table gets a computer and people can play with things in real time. I was at an expo, you know, a planner's expo, and the company that runs one of these kinds of software packages had a little booth set up and it was running a little competition, right? Who can get the highest score? Oh, well, if you do this and if you do, right? And everyone's having, they kept a running tally, and it was a lot of fun, actually. And other people say this is horribly exclusive. Horribly, it sounds great. If you're a white person who's comfortable, who has a dominant personality, says, do it this way, do it this way. And you're comfortable with computers. And so that's, people have worked with that. And so one easy way to get away from this is you just use Legos. And there's a popular approach called Reality Check, which just uses Legos. And then, which are, you know, very friendly, and the computer never gets in the way, either actually in the way or psychologically in the way. And then the technicians come around afterwards and count the Legos and put it into the computer because they still want the score, right? So there's all kind of different ways to do that, just like there are different ways to do counseling, but the end is the same. So I will wrap up this section, but let me take a deep breath and ask about questions. And I already see some frowns, which may or may not indicate engagement, or they may indicate doubt. And I don't know which. So, yes, Jennifer.
What were the three rents you couldn't get rid of it now? It's
one of the questions that I've been asked on every day, and I said I'd write something, and I didn't, about gentrification. and the right mix of single family and multifamily housing. And the community couldn't really come to an agreement on that.
I couldn't hear the first thing you said.
The right gentrification and the right mix of different amounts of affordability. And Pam was observing today after listening to Alan's discussion about conflict resolution, and Pam's observation was, you know, outside the mutuality of marriage or of a otherwise healthy relationship, the power dynamic in that is enormously important. And what if one of the parties has the ultimate veto, right? And in the Weymouth case, it was a naval Air Force base. The Navy has an Air Force, right? The Navy had the ultimate. It was their land. Now they couldn't do anything if the towns didn't agree, but they also could more or less they could pick between where this is the one, you know, they could, it was their land. So in that there was a power dynamic there that sort of hung over the towns, right? You figure it out and bring us something we like, or we're gonna do something else that you don't like. So that's like a parent with warring siblings, and you can sit down and go through the resolution process, but ultimately it's like, I'm the parent and you're not gonna come up with something that I want to let you do. So that's equivalent to much. Yes, Chris.
So the power thing and the slide you have up here bring to mind a case study which may take you way afield, and you can say, well, let's talk tonight over a beer about that. But in the end, the Minnesota Vikings stadium issue seemed to me to be resolved behind closed doors by a few legislators in conversation with the Vikings management.
Yes.
And they came up with an enormously positive tax situation supporting the Vikings.
Yes.
New billion-dollar stadium or whatever. So it feels to me like in that, and I don't have the sort of intellectual tools to analyze that very well, but it seems to me like power won.
Power won.
And the people didn't.
Yes.
And so there's this like level of mega projects.
Yes.
With major corporate interests that seem like on another scale than.
Yeah.
Are there different, what kinds of different case studies are there about urban land use? That's an urban land use case study, but it's not residential primarily.
Right,
This huge sort of engine of money and national distraction.
Yes. Well, in that case, you could try to shoehorn this, you could posit that the legislature stood in for public participation, right? We couldn't get all of Minnesota in a room to work on this, as we have been able to do in some other cases. So we hired legislators, and they did not represent us well for various power, bad organization of government, you know, and that is another discussion, I think. I like to pat my colleagues, I obviously did this all myself, I like to pat us on the back because we went into this enormously difficult direct democracy in New England, and we're so happy with ourselves that we made it work. Well, actually that was really easy because it's three small towns, right? And you can talk to most of the people. There's a little joke about Morris Udall wrote a book called Too Funny to Be President, and he collected all these campaign jokes, etc. He said, someone in New Hampshire was asked what he thought of Mo Udall when he was running. So I don't know. I've only met him three or four times. Right. So that's New England democracy. And when it gets to the level of the mega project, what do you do? They Chicago, Greater Chicago, and so not only the city, but all the collar counties that together have a regional government. Now, the regional government can't tell cities what to do, okay? But they collaborate, and they talk to each other. They sit down and, right? And they ran this process. They said, all these people, the demographers tell us all these people are coming to Chicago. Where shall we put them? and in what kind of land use and how should we serve them for transport, right? And they ran this process in Chicago. And the process, again, you know, the labels are so unhelpful because pre-process, everyone had their own ideas and the other people were stupid for thinking that that idea would, right? And everyone sits down and has a conversation and you have all these, literally have all these Legos. It's a very tactile product. That's the other criticism of this. It's not tactile. And that's not how really people think. At least not. So you have this pile of Legos and you have to put them someplace. And when people do that, they always end up putting, the other analogy which I've heard, when you ask children to plan cities, they always draw great, even if they've grown up in the suburbs, they do this, actually. Studies have proven. You give them Legos and you ask them to draw a city and plan a city, and they always do the grid and they put things in the middle and then kind of things kind of spread out. And so Chicago did it that way, and the report came out and said, you know, obviously they didn't get all 7 million people in Chicago in a room, but they had represented and they tried to find, you know, and that's a whole another exercise is getting a representative, right? So, you know, are the churches, the black churches, the white churches, the downtown Chicago, the suburbs, you know, and who represents you, and that's a whole other. But they did it pretty well, actually. And so at least you couldn't say that process was totally not legitimate because it didn't, right? So, I mean, people can always quibble, but you couldn't say that it wasn't utterly unrepresentative, right? And so they issued a report. And most of the cities in Chicago have taken it seriously and tried to advance that agenda. And so it is possible to do it well with really big numbers and really big projects. And I just think the Vikings thing was a travesty, to be honest. But why it happened that way is, in fact, a longer discussion. All right. I want to do a couple of other things here, and then we'll really have a longer discussion, not just questions about that. So we tell some stories about you're in conflict, and then we do some conflict resolution, and we try to take the emotion out of it by putting numbers on things. And remember, we go back to the ethos, logos, and pathos, and we try to take actually a little bit of the pathos out of it and really focus on the logos and get the facts. And then you can go back to the values. But history keeps moving, things keep moving, and now you've built the city or whatever, and they're like, well, maybe we shouldn't keep running the transit in this city because we need to save money. I know we kind of built it that way, but things are tight, and we need to save some money. And then you need to, Alan, once again, mentioned Coke as good at stealing, corporations are good at stealing are good ideas. What's another thing that they're very good at? With those, the Coke Gives Life or Coke Adds Life campaign ran for a long time. Did somebody forget that there was Coke out there? Oh my God, Coke! I never thought of that. Wow! Didn't they go someplace? No, they keep telling you over and over and over. So the other storytelling tip that I want to give you is to keep telling the story. And this is a much larger scale example again, but some of the Washington Metropolitan Transit Authority asked us because people really wanted to take money away from Metro. We can't afford you anymore. Right? Help us tell the story of why Metro is good. So again, computers again to our friend, computers to the ride to the rescue. You can fit Washington, D.C. inside a computer and then turn off the subway system. And what do people do? Well, they take a lot more cars, right? And then how many more highways would we have to build? Well, we'd have to build a lot of highways. How much would that cost? Well, it would cost about $7 billion just for the highways, not even buying the land. So we called up a lot of engineers and said, well, you know, a lot of people from Virginia take Metro across the river. How much would it cost to buy 3 new bridges? Well, it would cost a lot more, right? So we tell that story. And then once the cars have driven in from Virginia, where do they go? Well, we have to build a lot more parking. And so we found the cost of a debt. And so we know how many more parking spaces we need. We know how much a parking debt costs. We need actually 166 of these. That's a number. That's a number, okay? Now, that's a number. And people love, and my people love numbers, and that ought to be enough. I'm right. No, you have to draw a picture. Now you put 166 of these down in central D.C., and that's all there is? Except the White House. The first time we drew this picture, right, and we're like, something's wrong with that. Oh, yeah, the White House. We won't be able to tear down the White House and put parking there. But everything else is pretty much fair game, and that's another $4 billion. Okay? And then people will interrogate that story. Okay, I believe the facts. I believe that you called engineers and they totaled it all up. And I believe that it would cost him $10 billion, but I still am not buying your story. I'm not going to argue with you on the facts, because I can't. I'm still not buying it, right? Because why? Would that ever happen? Really?
No.
Right?
Yeah.
Really?
No.
Work with me here. Who's from Minneapolis? Surface parking in Minneapolis. We have covered Minneapolis with surface parking. Except for a little bit. This is our White House right here. Well, we're not going to tear that down. But everything else is pretty much
parked. Is that a stadium?
And this is the stadium. That's the other Holy of Holies. And this is a picture from about 10 years ago. And 6 years ago, correct me, Minneapolitans, if you're wrong, what did we do 6 years ago that goes like this?
Light rail.
Now people don't have to park as much. And what's here? This used to be surface parking 10 years ago, and it is now?
Housing.
And the Guthrie and Theater and the Mill City Museum. I mean, that was there anyway, but it was just an abandoned mill. Now it's a beautiful museum. And
McPhail.
And right here, actually, interestingly enough, is the American Institute of Neurology, which used to be in St. Paul. And the neurologists said, we are really sick of driving from downtown St. Paul to the airport, because we have to fly around to the experts and tell people stories about what they should do. We want to be on the light rail line. The neurologists. Poor people take transit? No, the neurologists don't take transit. So we're telling a new story here that if you build it, they will come. That's another good story. And this story informs this story, because when people say, I buy your facts, but I'm still not buying the story, you have to have another story with which to engage with them. And you have to use pictures. And then the last thing that we did, showing pictures-wise, is we did some archaeology. And people will ask, well, how did that story turn out? Right? When we tell our children, when we use storytelling with their children, every story is a claim, and every claim can be converted into a story. Eat your beans because they are good for you is a claim. It's actually a requirement, right? What's the story version of it? Turn that into a story for me. Once upon a time, there was a child who didn't eat his beans, and he got sick. Well, has that ever happened? Is the response, right? Tell me a story about a child that didn't eat his beans and actually got sick. So we tell the story going forward in Washington that if you turn off Metro, if you take all its money away, bad things will happen. And they're like, yeah, well, okay, maybe in Minneapolis they were dumb and covered there, but that we still wouldn't do that here. And then so we go back and we say, even in Washington there's a powerful story here. So we found, when Washington was growing up, and it used to be a sleepy, small southern town, President Kennedy used to say it was the city of northern charm and southern efficiency. And it had this grid that Pierre L'Enfant laid out, and it's a nice grid, but it was outliving its use, and we had to get more people downtown, right? So what was the plan? Archaeology. He spent so much time in the archives looking for this map. Because everyone knew that there had been a plan, but try and find it, right? So this was the freeway that was going to serve Washington. And here's the map, 1971. So now we go to where the big interchange was going to be, okay? and it's in the Mount Vernon Square neighborhood. And what's there now? This is here now, one of the most sought-after apartment buildings in Washington. Life is there now. Community is there now. And they literally would have covered the whole. So you have to tell a story. Then telling the numbers is not enough. And you have to, once upon a time there was a plan to serve Washington, and there were different stories about how that ending would go, and we tested it against history, and this worked better. And we can show you the pictures. So I'm going to wrap up with an entirely different analogy. A good friend and colleague of mine is Dan Burton, and he has spent, and thank God I don't do this, in the last 4 years he's been to 850 towns helping them figure out what to do with their towns by invitation. He's not coming in with a power, do you have to do this? Oh, you have some people call him, right? He's in high demand. And his favorite analogy is that you don't have to leave home. People are always threatening to move to Europe for nice cities, right? You don't have to go to Europe. You don't have to leave home. We know what to do right here. And every city, and he's been to a lot of them, so I trust him when he says this, has the know-how within it. And we have the brains, right? And we have the heart. His view is that the big missing link in most, it's not even experts what to do, it's the courage to do something else. And I will be the first person to say that in a lot of cases I lack that courage because I look out and the job is so big. The wall looks so high. Right? And it's hard to imagine that you're going to change that. But Dan does it every day, and there are a lot of success stories like this, and I just told the stories that I've been involved with, not to pat myself on the back, but because they're my stories, and so I can tell them well. If someone asks me a question about what happened, I actually know what happened, and so I can answer the question. But there are a lot of those stories like that, and there's really good news out there. We're not remotely done yet. It took us about, depending on where you start counting, 50, 60, 70 years to get into the planning and transportation mess that we're in. We don't have 70 years to get out of it, but we're getting out of it. And so I just wanted to tell a couple of happy stories as examples of what we can do. And suggest that we can overcome these ideological arguments. I'll just end with a couple of other thoughts, and then let's have some discussion. We actually do have 15 minutes for discussion, which is lovely. When we're invited into towns, often people will say, I've read about smart growth, and I want you to come talk about it, and I want you to help our people talk about it. Please don't mention smart growth, because it's such a sense, it's a live, and people hear, oh, so you're saying that my growth is dumb growth? Is that what you're saying? And so today was all about, so don't mention smart growth, right? Take it out of it and observe, right? And then talk on the basis of those observations and leave the evaluation out of it until a little later. Another part of the movement says, no, I'm not going to give that up. That's our brand. And if you want to do something else, you've got to go develop a story behind it, and it's just like Coke. Coke doesn't advertise itself as the water that will quench your thirst and taste kind of good, and, you know, it's really up to you. No. Like, Coke is great. You should buy it. They defend their brand. And so a lot of folks in the movement want to defend that brand and say, no, you want a city that works? Do smart growth and do it this way. And if you don't like it, you know, then you're wrong. You're just wrong, right? I can see both sides of that. And you can probably see both sides of it. Some of it's going to depend on your community and the situation that you're in, et cetera. So I am One of the other things that I said one of the other days is try and talk to people where they are, and sometimes people will be ready to hear, this whole thing has been worked out, it's called smart growth, and wouldn't you like, and it works, wouldn't you like to do it? And sometimes that works, and other times, forget it. The well has been poisoned, and so you can't go there. So it's, right, temper the words to the audience, I guess. But I do try and take some lessons from corporations, at least, and they are very good at that. So, you know, sometimes the brain works, and if it does, go with it. In the war over urban design, and I assure you that it is a war, with fatalities, right? Because this way kills fewer people crossing the street, and the other way kills a lot of people every year. We lose more people in auto accidents every year than we lost in Vietnam. So it is a war with real fatalities. At one of these debates that we have at these conferences, one of my colleagues got up and they said, you know, you did this, that's smart growth. And someone said, well, what if you did it that, you know, you don't do X and X works. So you're not, and my colleague said, oh, well, we'll do that too. That's smart growth too. Since it works, that we do that. And the other thing said, you can't do that. You can't just claim everything that works as smart growth. No, that's exactly what we do. If it works, we're going to do it, right? This isn't an argument over a set of dogma that if you give up one part of it, you know, the other guy won. No, we're looking for what works. It's a human experiment. And if it works, we're going to do it. And we're going to call that the thing that works. And we're going to claim it. We'll take that back. Thank you very much. So if something works, I encourage you to claim that as well. And if you want to put it as part under a brand and that works in your situation, do that. And if you don't, if you think it doesn't work, then that's fine too. So those are some thoughts that I had while walking down from Heart Lake today. And I just had the most fantastic walk. And I saw the most fantastic birds feeding over this creek. And it was beautiful. And I just sat there for a long time and watched the birds fly. And so once again, thank you, Chris, for having me. Thank you for coming and listening. And it's just been the greatest privilege for me. Thank you very much. So we have time left. And tell me what you think. Interrogate my story. Yes?
But what happens to people? How do you keep a community together when you have a developer? He's a hometown boy. And he's been to the university. And it's close to the university. And all these wonderful things. And he comes in and he plans a four-story building, would take out seven businesses and a single-family home, and it's right on the line. It's on the corner. The whole building will be on the line.
Uh-huh.
And they'll have small businesses down below, but we've never been able to keep small businesses in. And, you know, I mean, how do you fight a guy like that? This thing is so out of scale for the community that it's just, like, overwhelming, and the first thing people say is, who's going to live there? You know, I mean, they don't need it for students to live there. Who's going to live there? So, you know, how do you fight something like that? This guy just comes in and says, oh, yeah, we've been working on this for 4 years. Okay.
Well, I could suggest how to use the process to fight it, but the first thing that I would do is try to, modeling the advice from this morning, understand a lot more about the situation. I trust your version of it, but there may be other versions.
Well, I know a lot more about it. But,
right.
But it's kind of like, in my mind, backwards, upside down, something. There's a bunch of land behind it. They're going to use that for parking. Why don't they put the building there?
Yeah.
You know?
All I can suggest, and I don't... Where are you from?
Tacoma.
Tacoma.
Actually, we're out by Pacific Lutheran University.
This is
the university's all for it.
This is a pretty common fight. We just had one in our neighborhood, literally, where there's a fast food restaurant, which used to be a gas station, on one of the corners of our little downtown, and the other three corners are lovely, and this is not. And the developer who lives in the neighborhood, just like your story,
yeah.
Right?
The guy's nice. Everybody likes him.
Proposed a building which about half the neighborhood thought was fantastic, and he ran little, you know, some, he he didn't do exactly this, okay? So that was where he screwed up. He didn't do exactly what I told him to do. And about half the neighborhood absolutely hated it because it's out of scale. It's to the, you know. I could explain to you why up to the line is good. I could explain to you why density is good. I could explain to you why all of these things are probably good.
I hear the story.
Yeah, exactly. But in our neighborhood, anyway, people just hated it because it was changed and it was out of scale. And so all I can do is to suggest, again, a different process. If he has been working on this in secret for 4 years and springs it on you, that's bad process. It's just bad process. And, it produces the reaction you have. How can we fight it?
Yeah.
Not how can we understand it, not how can we...
Well, we understand it. Well, it's like you say.
Okay, all right. So, I don't know if you can fight it or not. I mean, I could suggest ways to fight it. I don't know if I would help you fight it.
It's political. It's all political.
It's a done deal.
Yeah, I think it's a done deal before we ever heard about it.
Mary, yes. About the process.
Yes.
Is it more typical that a developer sees the land first and they want to jump on it, and you come in later and try to repair the damage, or is it? Well, you know what I mean.
I know what you mean. Yes. There's no typical. Situation, I guess, is what I would say. But in this case, I'll just give you the only way I can answer that question is through some examples. In this case, a developer had taught the Navy and the developer, I don't know who went first, but anyway, the Navy and a developer had a deal to build this. And they couldn't get it through that one town that wanted a smart growth. So, and they were at a stalemate.
Okay.
And so they called and they said, I don't know what we're going to do. These towns are like this. They can't agree on a vision. A smart developer might come to a firm like this first and develop the vision first. Or a smart mayor of Chicago might say, let's run a big process and understand what we want this region to look like. And then when I propose a transit line or I propose a bunch of redevelopment over here, I'm doing what the community has already said it wants. Right. Right?
And then the developers come in and make it happen.
Exactly.
But it seems backwards to me that it ever, that they came up with this idea and tried to sell it that took tons of time,
sure,
and money and effort.
Sure it did.
This is silly, but why doesn't everybody use your maybe I should start an ad campaign.
Why doesn't everyone just talk to each other, Alan?
Okay, we'll see you
then. No. And so, okay, tell some, I'm going to be annoying on this point, maybe a little bit, but tell yourself a story, or try and write a story about the people involved here. So you're the bureaucrat, and I used to be a bureaucrat, so at the Navy, who's charged of getting rid of this land. Okay, you're a facilities guy. You don't study, or you never went and heard this Will Schroer guy talk about community engagement. Your job is to sell a base. I called up a bunch of developers. Hey, what do you want to do? Well, malls are selling right now. Let's build a mall. Done. That was easy. Okay? And 99% of the times, the Navy guys can do that, because where are their bases? They're not next to Boston. They're in the middle of nowhere someplace. And so they, sell this base. Okay. I mean, it's never that easy, right? But so put yourself in his shoes.
But
he's just trying to get something done.
That does just fly through, and that's why we've got all this junk.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Right. Exactly. Exactly.
So the takeaway is to get involved and find out what's happening.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately. I appreciated Mark's talk on perseverance and the need to just keep showing up. And, the citizens that go to every planning meeting and so they don't get surprised by something, hats off to them. It's a tough job. Sometimes they get a little bitter. I get that. You gotta stay engaged. Yes.
I got a goofy one though.
Yeah, please. No such thing.
Well, since I'm from Minneapolis though, if you go back to the map of Minneapolis.
Yeah.
And where they put the baseball field,
yep.
Target field.
Yeah.
Is that a smart move or not?
It was Well, let's leave the whether it's smart to pay for a baseball field out of it, and where is the right place to put the baseball field. So, for non-Minneapolitans, this is one of our freeways goes through here. Used to be a railroad track, and for what it's worth, all of this used to be rail yards. Okay, and so and they served the flour mills that were on the river. So the railroads went away, the flour mills went away, and the rye is a whole other question. Anyway, now it's surface parking, and now we're reclaiming it. Here's a freeway, a sunken freeway, which also used to be rail lines, and there was some vacant land on either side of the sunken freeway, because who wants to live on a sunken piece of land next to a freeway? And so they were trying to figure out where to put this baseball stadium, and this is one of the other arenas. We're horribly over-arenaed in Minneapolis, just like most places. But and the light rail line comes right down here, and it did end here. And the thought was, let's put the baseball stadium over the sunken freeway, which no one wants anyway, and we'll extend the light rail line so you can go from, actually it's over here. So we'll extend the light rail line so you can walk from the train to the baseball game. I think it was a great place. I thought it was a perfect place. If you're going to pay for a baseball stadium.
And the train also goes the other direction.
And the train also goes the other, of course.
And they have the North Star going up north.
Yes, exactly.
The new other route.
Yes, it goes over the Knapp-Bridge Bridge.
Right.
And actually, what's interesting is now a lot of people are moving to this old warehouse district, and the train is a big draw. And as you might know, this profession produces all kinds of stories, and I just have to inflict them on people. We were in another town, and they had a very similar, so everyone has old rail yards that no one wants to live next to, right? So they're trying to do a plan for that part of the city, and they come up with some plans for most of it, and they said, well, we still haven't figured what next put to the rail yards. What are we going to put there? And the chief architect says, we'll put the really expensive condos next to the train tracks, because those rich people love to be next to the old pretty stuff now. And it's true. And they were the first ones to sell. It's real. I don't know. Just random stories like that. Anyway, that's my answer to your
question. Yeah, so it's a good spot.
It's a great spot.
Yeah, okay.
Because it's where people can get to it.
Yeah.
Right? And B, nobody else wanted to do anything with that land anyway. My story that I just told notwithstanding. And it really works, and once again, I'm a little bit of a crank on the subject, but it really disproves the idea that, you know, transit, the rich white people won't take transit. Everybody takes transit. Pam and I were on the train, and it's not even a game, right? Pam and I were on the light rail one day, and it was packed with middle-aged white guys and their sons in truckers' caps. No uniforms, though. No jerseys. It was off-season, and you know, the hockey wasn't playing. So I finally asked one of them, well, where the hell are you guys all going? We're going to the tractor pull at the dome.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly.
We've broken through. When the guys going to the tractor pull are taking the train, we've broken through. What else? All right, well, thank you so much. It's really been my honor. Thank you very much.